fermentation. When it comes to fermentation, what's old is new again, kind of. Your grandparents may have made sauerkraut or put up naturally fermented pickled vegetables. Well, today you might be experimenting with home-brewed kombucha or ordering kimchi coleslaw with your hamburger. There are all kinds of reasons fermentation is a hot food trend, not the least of them is health. The new focus on one's gut biome has people turning to fermented foods. But not all fermented foods are equal. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we go beyond refrigerator pickled cucumbers, though those are delicious, and into the world of fermentation. What are your questions for our food experts? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yes, it's Valentine's Day, and there are lots of sweet treats being consumed today. So we thought we'd balance that with a little bit of sour. We're talking about fermentation and why this old technique is being embraced anew. Joining me in the studio, Kate Wallace, who is Programming Director at the Resilience Hub. Nancy Harmon Jenkins, a food historian and journalist, author and speaker. And Justin Amaral, the co-owner and head of lab services of Maniacal Yeast Labs. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever tried fermenting anything? Do you have health questions? Do you think fermented foods are healthy? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. Nancy, I'm going to start with you. We think of fermented foods as very trendy, very hot, very hip, but this is not new, is it?
No, it's not new at all. And I find that absolutely fascinating. I'm curious. I hope somebody during this show is going to explain to me how this became such a hot or cool topic. Because we've had these things for years and years, not for years, for centuries, for millennia. And if all you have to do is stop and look around your kitchen and look at the wine, the beer, the yogurt, the cheese, the bread, if it's made with a sourdough, the hams and prosciuttos and salamis that you might have tucked away in your meat drawer. Those are all, fermentation is part of what makes them so tasty. I think fermentation really is at the root of that elusive thing called umami, which is that kind of almost meaty, mouth-filling flavor that you get from foods that have nothing to do with meat. And I think fermentation is at the heart of that.
Justin, I'm going to turn to you for the definition of fermentation. Making refrigerator pickles, which I love to do, that's not fermentation, right?
No, that's just using pasteurized vinegar. You're not actually fermenting anything. You're just pickling something.
So what's the difference?
Well, pickling is using a vinegar, for instance, that you'd buy in store that's already pasteurized. There's no microbes in it. It's merely serving the purpose of an acid to actually pickle something. Fermentation is how that acid got created in the first place. So a microbe man ate sugar, it created its acid, and then we used it. So in vinegar's sense, it's a acetic acid bacteria. So they pasteurize that, and then you get what we have now. But if you were not to pasteurize that, you would have a pickled fermentation, but you actually fermented the brine to make the vinegar.
It's kind of tricky because some pickles are fermented and some are not. And I've read this morning to look on the label for something that says naturally fermented. That means that microbes were involved, right?
Yes. If it says it naturally fermented or it says, contains live microbes, that means that they were involved in the process.
Kate, you guys are about to have a fair. Tell me about this.
Yeah. So the fermentation fair idea was born out of this idea that fermenting is actually quite easy and that most people can learn how to ferment something in less than half an hour. And so our idea was that we would gather a bunch of fermentation hobbyists who could demonstrate different techniques of fermentation all in one space in 3 hours. And we are realizing just how popular this is. We've had our Facebook event explode with interest. And we're really excited about it.
What are people saying? Why are they so excited about it?
I think that there are a number of different reasons. I think that there's been a lot of press about the health benefits of fermentation. In our community, we have people who are growing a lot of food, and so they're looking for ways to preserve that food in healthy ways. And I also just think that the flavors of fermentation are so interesting and different and unique. And so, you know, for those reasons, we're seeing a lot of interest.
All right. And now I'm going to qualify this by saying that none of us in this room is a health professional. But what do we know about the health benefits of fermentation generally?
I'm going to defer to Justin, is it, on that? Because
yes.
I think he knows a lot more about this than I do.
So there's only really been a few studies actually done on the probiotic benefits of fermentation. We know in general that, you know, probiotics is a thing that can help you, but, you know, just fermenting like a sauerkraut and eating it isn't going to help you like maybe the way you want it to, just because we don't understand the microbes you're kind of eating. You know, if you've ever heard of a product called Good Belly, that's a probiotic shot that a lot of people take. That is a well-studied product that it can essentially say that these microbes will help your gut bacteria.
Excuse me, did you say it's a shot?
Yeah, well, not like, sorry, like a shot you take, like,
not like
with a syringe, no, not an injection, no. Okay.
That would be brutal.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's a very well documented study. A lot of our thoughts about probiotics has actually come off of that study, so a lot of it is anecdotal. When people say that, you know, they drink kombucha and it's probiotic, chances are that is true, but we don't know that to be 100% true because there's no study saying so. So it's kind of, you know, take everything you hear about it with a grain of salt, but we also know there are benefits to it. We just don't fully understand it yet.
All right. Well,
I was thinking that yogurt is the classic example. People with an upset stomach, children with an upset stomach, you give them a good tablespoon of plain yogurt without any sugar or flavorings in it, and it helps to restore the balance in your gut. Whether you're suffering from a hangover or from an upset from eating the wrong kind of food or whatever, something about the probiotic benefits of yogurt acts in the gut.
Sure, and a medical professional will tell you often if you have to go on to antibiotics to, for example, eat yogurt.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that a health benefit with fermented foods, especially lacto-fermented foods where lactobacillus is present, like sauerkraut or vegetable salt ferments, that food is pre-digested to a degree. Those organisms are present in your digestive tract, and so it's easier on your system to process in some cases.
All right. Well, Justin, I understand there's a little bit of an interesting story about how you came to this. Tell me how you came into fermentation as your life's work or your life so far. You're young.
Well, it actually started off in wine, so honey wine. It really just got kind of, I don't know, out of control. but I got obsessed with making honey wine, and then I was really more obsessed with what was happening in the fermentation. That kind of led down the rabbit hole. You know, suddenly I was making beer, mead, sake, anything I could ferment. And then about a year into it, I started studying more about the microbiology and chemistry behind it. So, you know, I started getting my hands on all the resources I could. So everything you would study in college, I started talking with microbiologists. So everything you would basically learn in a college, you know, in courses for microbiology and chemistry, involving fermentation, that is. And I kind of did this for a few years and just kind of kept building up information and collecting info. And then I just decided to start doing my own research projects with that knowledge, which kind of led down the path of me building my own laboratory in my house. So I had to play with that for quite a bit to, of course, get the hang of it and put everything I had learned into practice. So, you know, years down the road, I finally decided I would actually open up a commercial lab. And I decided to kind of get more involved in food, anything fermentation. I just decided to dip my hands in. So
when you have a commercial lab, who are your customers? Who comes to you?
So mostly breweries. We do sell to some distilleries, wineries, and we've sold to a sake place as well.
Uh-huh.
So it's mostly alcohol. We have helped a couple bread makers, like with their sourdough culture. So we have messed around a little bit with food, but it's generally the alcohol industry that comes to us.
All right. Now, Nancy, my understanding of fermentation throughout history has been as a means of preservation. But that's not really complete understanding.
No, I think it also has to do with the enjoyment of food because you change a food. I mean, sauerkraut is the very best example of that. You can keep cabbages in the appropriate environment, and I don't mean freezing. I mean in a cold cellar, the way everybody always did in Maine. You can keep them through the year, and, you know, gradually as you use them, you'll have to take more and more of the outside leaves off because they start to get a little rancid on the outside. Or you can transform that into sauerkraut, as the Germans did in Waldeboro, where they're still making sauerkraut today. And you have an entirely new product that it's better for you probably than it's easier to digest than raw cabbage. But on the other hand, it also tastes so much better. I'm so old, I can remember all of these things. I remember when they used to put signs up in the windows that said, "Kraut's here." And that would be in the late fall when Morse's sauerkraut was ready to be sold. And people would almost line up to get these white containers of fresh sauerkraut and just stand there and eat it because it was so delicious just coming out of the vat. And it was a wonderful food. It still is a wonderful food. But and people tend to think about cooking with it, which is another thing entirely. But just eating it as it is so refreshing and fulfilling and satisfying. And I think that's true of a lot of fermented products. I mean, pork products, that's another one that I got very interested in. And I was talking with a pork products producer in Rockport yesterday, this guy Oliver Perkins, who's making a lot of salamis and what he calls muscle cuts, like bacon and stuff like that. And the fermentation that goes on, especially in a really good salami, is an important part of adding that flavor to it, that umami that makes you want to keep coming back and having just another little slice.
Kate, tell me what kinds of fermentation you find there to be the most interest in. Are young people making sauerkraut or is it something else?
I would say that probably kombucha might be the most popular ferment at this point in
okay,
time.
And for people who are not in on the trend, listeners who are not in on the trend, what is kombucha?
Yeah, so kombucha is a fermented tea, essentially. So the kombucha culture is called a SCOBY, which means symbiotic collection of bacteria and yeast. And,
oh, I never knew it was an acronym. Okay,
yeah,
go on. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's a bacteria and yeast fermentation. And to make it, you basically make a sweet tea and you add this culture along with a small amount from a previous batch. And it makes a really nice sort of tangy, you know, sweet tea. And the longer you ferment it, it can sort of take on vinegar characteristics, can be used in salad dressings, which I love to do because I always let mine go way too long. I think in addition to kombucha, you know, fermentation in general is becoming more popular. I mean, if you look at yeast ferments, you see, you know, the beer and wine industry, local industry in Maine exploding. In terms of lacto ferments, which are like sauerkrauts and vegetables and yogurts, you know, you look at the local cheese industry, and you have all these farms who are growing really great stuff and making really great fermented products. I think that it's sort of blowing up on all fronts.
Yes. I just wanted to add on the kombucha front that I think it's this Saturday, the Lincolnville General Store in Lincolnville Center is having a kombucha tasting of all the different kinds of kombucha that they're offering there.
It's interesting to me, we're using words like kombucha and kimchi,
yes,
but we're
exactly.
also talking about things like sauerkraut. It seems to me this sense of fermentation or the history of fermentation crosses a lot of cultures.
Oh, it's in every culture. Every food culture around the globe, I dare say, has some form of fermentation, initially just to preserve a food. But I think in this country in particular, in recent years with kombucha and kimchi and things like that, the interest in Asian processes of fermentation has become really, really very strong. But it exists in traditional South American cultures and certainly in Europe and in Asia and in Africa, too. So there's lots to be learned once you set yourself on the path to fermentation.
And our producer, Cindy, is reminding us of fermented shark in Iceland.
Yep. Greenland shark.
So, yes. Justin, I need to ask you, what is the strangest thing you've ever tried to ferment and how did it go?
That's a good question.
Or just name a top five if you can't narrow it down to one.
I guess one everyone thought I was going to give myself botulism, but I did a ferment of a ham in liquid. So I fermented an entire ham inside of a vat of liquid. I inoculated with good bacteria and I dropped it to a pH that was safe, so I knew it was safe, but on its surface, looking at it, it would look like I was going to kill myself.
Was it a raw ham?
Yeah, it was completely raw.
So it was a piece of raw pork, basically.
Yeah, it was just a big old cut that I put in a vat with black lava sea salt, a bunch of herbs, and then my lactobacillus culture, and then I just had a sous vide on it at like 100 degrees, which is the no-no temp for most food, but I was doing it knowing that I was inoculating it with good bacteria.
And how did it taste?
It actually softened up quite a bit on the texture. You know, that's not going to get too far into the meat, but the point was to kind of make the outside, you know, some of the enzymes start to denature and kind of unravel, which makes your meat softer.
But wasn't the traditional way of preserving pork here in the North? I know in Italy and Spain and France, the hams, for instance, were dried in order to preserve and cure them, but in the north of Europe, they were put in a salt brine, weren't they?
Yeah, so there's a salt brine they use. It's basically the high salinity of the salt is really what kind of saves them. There's bacteria in there, of course, doing their job, but it's the bacteria you want to be there. So then the salt kind of helps them be there.
What are some things that are fermented that may not pop into mind? I mean, you know, we've been talking about sauerkraut, we've been talking about yogurt, and that makes sense. But there are things that are sort of everyday products like soy sauce that mm-hmm. are fermented, correct?
Yep. Soy sauce, fish sauce, some mustards, like almost half of the condiments you see on your shelves, you can assume there's a fermented version of it.
Sriracha?
Yep. Sriracha is fermented for a couple of years.
And I've read, but I haven't found any instructions for it, that ketchup, and I mean tomato ketchup, not mustard, or I mean walnut ketchup or anything like that. Traditionally, tomato ketchup was fermented, was part of the process of producing it. And I imagine it must have been a much tastier product than what we get now.
Kate?
Yeah, people would use, so I've made a fermented ketchup with a small addition of whey or even like a vinegary kombucha. And basically any condiment that you make can be lacto-fermented with a small addition of, and I think that that's a great way to introduce fermented foods into people's diets who may not, you know, want to eat sauerkraut. They might be freaked out by kombucha, but if you have a lacto-fermented mustard, it tastes quite nice and is a good way to add beneficial bacteria to the diet.
Okay, so before we go to a break, does anybody want to shout out? I'll put you on the spot first, Nancy. Do you have a favorite fermented food?
Oh, all of them. I mean, I love sourdough bread. I love cheese. I love wine. I love really good beer.
Oh, you're making me hungry.
I know. If I could just sit down. And, you know, sometimes I think if I could have a diet of that for the rest of my life, and oranges in the wintertime and tomatoes in the summer, I could be a happy person.
Your turn, Kate.
I have been making a fennel sauerkraut for the last few years that I just absolutely love. And when it's gone, I get really sad. So I would say that's my favorite.
Do you have it written down into a recipe we can share?
No, but I can tell you it is cabbage, salt, and fennel seeds pounded in the traditional way that you make sauerkraut. And
so you add fennel seeds pounded? Traditional recipe.
Yep. So I pound the fennel seeds in with the salt and the cabbage.
Ah, okay. Justin, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, it's going to be something charcuterie, probably jamón serrano, which is Iberico black hogs that are fed off of only acorns in Spain, and then they hang them up. It's a specific cut. They hang this up for about 3 to 4 years to age, and it just tastes like pure acorn meal.
Mm. And Nancy's nodding as you say that.
Yes.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions about fermentation. This is Maine Calling. We'll be back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and Insulation Rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Even though there are drugs to treat HIV and prevent new infections, people in Mississippi today are still dying of AIDS.
It was like a repeated broken record over and over again. You know, you're not good enough. You're never going to have anybody. No one is going to love you because you have this disease.
I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting on what it will take to meet the president's goal of ending AIDS in a decade. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is coming up today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. This spring and summer, Maine Public News will be on the road, stopping in communities all around the state to talk to you about the important issues in your community and what topics are most important for us to report on. More on that as we get closer, but right now, as a lead up to the tour, we have a statewide survey we'd like you to fill out. It only takes a few minutes. Visit mainpublic.org and click on Events and the Tell Me More survey. Or if you aren't online, call Audience Services at 1-800-884-1717 and we'll get one right out to you. Thanks. Your participation will ensure Maine Public News serves you better in the months ahead.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, fermentation, what it's all about. Joining me in the studio, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, food expert, journalist, historian, and author. Justin Amaral, co-owner and head of lab services at Maniacal Yeast Labs. And Kate Wallace, programming director at Resilience Hub. We would like you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Simon Frost. He is co-owner of Triple Acre Farm in Whitefield. Hi, Simon. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's 30-acre farm.
What did I say? Oh, I said triple acre, 30-acre farm. I have it written both ways. I apologize for that. So tell us about why 30-acre farm is on a show about fermentation. What kind of fermented products do you sell?
Well, we sell sauerkrauts and kimchi and hot sauces that we make from the organic produce that we grow on our farm. And, yeah, our road to fermentation has come from farming, really, or has gone through farming, and we were looking for ways to preserve our products that we grow and increase their shelf life and enhance their value, flavor, and nutrition.
So how long have you been fermenting products and selling them?
About 14 years now.
Oh, so have you seen a growth in interest in those products?
Yeah, for sure. We've been very lucky in that it's been a rising trend since we started making our product, it seems. And we've always experienced growth.
What are your customers saying to you? Why are they buying your products?
I think they mostly because they taste good, but there's definitely more and more in the press about fermented products and the health benefits and, they're just the far-reaching effects of having a little bit of fermented food in your diet.
What's your most popular product?
Right now, probably sauerkraut and kimchi.
Sauerkraut and kimchi. So two different cultures represented in one farm. What are you looking to next? Any ideas of what your next big product's going to be?
Well, we really are enjoying making hot sauces right now. You guys are talking a lot about stuff we've been thinking about with mustards and ketchups and sauces, but we're focusing on hot sauce at the moment.
All right. Well, Simon, thank you so much for calling in. Simon Frost, co-owner of 30 Acre Farm in Whitefield. We're going to go to Jesse, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. This is a perfectly timed show for me because I just switched brands this weekend of sourdough bread based on what I read on the internet. They said that a true sourdough bread has a sourdough starter and whole grain. And if you're getting a bread, sourdough bread, that has yeast in it or other items, it's not a true traditional sour bread and sourdough bread, and you won't get the true benefits of a traditional sourdough bread. I checked out four local, I won't mention the names because I don't want to diss anybody, and one of them advertising their items, ingredients, sourdough starter. Another one lists sourdough starter and cider for two of their popular brands. A national brand had listed yeast, and the other one listed just yeast and cider, and then the national one did yeast, and another one just listed neither, and the website suggested that if nothing's listed, assume sourdough starter.
Okay.
I would like their opinions because it's supposed to help break down the gluten for digestion if you have a traditional sourdough bread.
All right. Well, Jesse, I see out of the corner of my eye Nancy nodding as you're talking, so I'm going to turn to Nancy.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of theorizing about how sourdough breaks down glutens, and I don't want to go there because I have some controversial opinions about glutens. But sourdough, yes. If sourdough is mixed with yeast, the yeast will take over from the sourdough and you won't get the benefits from it. However, you said it has to be made with sourdough and it has to be made with whole grain, meaning the whole grain is ground up in the processing of the flour. That's not true. You can also make a sourdough with white flour. Obviously, it's not going to be as nutritious as the whole grain one is, but nonetheless, it can be done. But I agree with you, absolutely. I think sourdough, it makes the bread so much tastier and presumably better for you, gluten or not. It's going to be better for you because it's a traditional, natural, old-fashioned process, and we like those best.
Well, I have something to add as well. So we do a lot of sourdough isolation in the lab. All sourdough has multiple yeast strains and bacteria. The yeast is what's responsible for creating the air pockets, of course. Sourdough yeast are generally not as aggressive, which is why they ferment longer. They just don't create the CO2 like you buy a pack.
So it's not that it doesn't have yeast. It's a different kind of yeast.
Yeah, and it can even be the same species that you go buy in a store. But, you know, that's just like saying, you know, we're the same species, but we're all different. So that applies the same to yeast strains. So, you know, a sourdough capture would have traditionally been spontaneous. Either it's in your flour or it's microbes landing in your ferment. And you're kind of adding a piece of where you are. But traditionally a sourdough would be just kind of repitched over and over and over and over and over for generations in a family because they want to hold on to that. But there is definitely benefits to them over regular bread. You know, you do have the bacteria involved. There could be a probiotic aspect to it. But as far as the glutens, there's never been research that show they break down any gluten, actually, like molecules. No, there's really been very few microbes that have the ability to do that.
Well, thanks, Jesse, for your call. We're going to go now to Bob Sewell. He owns Sewell Organic Orchards. Thanks for calling in, Bob.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. I'm hungry, to be honest with you. You have been operating your organic apple orchard for decades now. How did you get into fermentation?
Well, fermentation was a way for me to extend my crop, being able to market it without a whole lot of refrigeration here. I found that if I took my cider and fermented it, mainly by starting with some of my cider that I'd refrigerated at about 40 degrees in a sealed container, it tends to turn to alcohol. That yeast is still pretty strong. My apples have about 25,000 different yeast on them, so you bring them in, the temperature really controls what will start, and in that anaerobic container, it will turn to alcohol, and I'd take that and I'd put it into my cider, and then after a while, I allow it to be aerobic. I allow the air to get to it. The alcohol tends to get it working faster, and I like to ferment my cider at 60 degrees, and those colder temperatures tend to have more hearty yeast and a better flavor, and it takes me about 3 years to get it the way I like it because I won't heat it and I won't add anything to it.
Wow. So I understand your apple cider vinegar is so good. Many of the top restaurants in Maine use it. What? And Nancy's nodding as I talk. What is it about your apple cider vinegar? What, if I were to taste it, what would it taste like? And what makes it so wonderful?
I don't know. My mother was Italian, so you know it has to taste good to me. If it doesn't taste good to me, I don't want to put it out there. And I think you know a lot of the nutrients that we have, the land that I planted the trees on, never used for commercial orchards, so I don't have to, you know, worry about a lot of the other problems with, having sprays. And I don't spray at all on my trees, so I don't have, you know, old types of sprays that had heavy metals and stuff like that. And I'm not using nitrates, which tend to rob foods of their flavor. And it's really nice to have the chefs. And one in particular, I asked him, I said, well, how many dishes do you use in? And he goes, everything. And I go, well, why, you know, why in every dish? He says, it's a yin and yang. It balances the food flavors. So
Bob, I'm going to go to another caller because I think his question is for you. So hold on the line. Okay. Here we go. I'm going to go to Tom, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. What's your question?
Actually, it's not a question, but there's a gentleman that I'm sure Mrs. Sewell knows. His name is Michael Phillips, and he runs Lost Nation Orchard. And he runs one of the largest organic orchards in New England. And he gave me a recipe for garlic beer that he uses sometimes to spray on his trees. So he ferments it, and it's a mild fungicide. It's a micronutrient foliar feed, and it's a feeding inhibitor and feeding suppressor.
Okay. Okay. So I think I was wrong. Bob Sewell at Sewell Organic Orchards. This is not a question for you, or is it? Do you use a garlic beer?
No, I don't. But I know Michael very well, and I'm familiar with a lot of his techniques. But foliar sprays and stuff like that, I haven't gotten into, and I am at a point where I might start looking at that because my trees are almost 40 years old. I planted them in the 1980. So we're looking at, really trying to balance the nutrients in the trees, and I want to keep them alive a lot longer if I can.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That's Bob Sewell with Sewell Organic Orchards, and a question from Tom in Bath. Moving on to Becky, who's calling from North Haven. Hi, Becky. Go ahead.
Hi. This is a wonderful program. I actually don't have a question, but I have been doing a lot of fermenting for a long time, starting with sourdough bread and yogurt probably 50 years ago. And I have gone into doing things like making my own miso and vinegar because I have apple trees here out in North Haven. But the thing that my favorite ferment, just you asked that question, is in the spring when curly dock and dandelion, and I usually leave a few kale plants so they, put out some spring growth, and pretty much anything green you can eat in the garden I chop up and add some of last year's garlic, or if I have any spring garlic, I throw it in there with salt, and sometimes I don't add any, but sometimes I add caraway or dill seed or something else, and it is, it's to die for. It's so good. It just feels like you are getting through all of the winter things that you had wrong with you are gone by the time you eat that up. So anyway.
That's great, Becky. Thank you.
Is that fermented, Becky? Do you layer it with salt and leave it for a while?
Yeah, it's herbal. So I just, I pound everything. I grind it up. I keep it in a crock, and I have a rock that I weight down and make sure that there's fluid on top, and, skim off the scum, and then bottle it up if I ever get enough. I never can get enough of that one. But
so it's sort of like what the French call les herbes salées that are... Yeah. Our French friends in Maine make every year and use, they add it to soups and sauces and things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do add it to many different things. I actually want to say that I was inspired to go beyond, sourdough and yogurt and kombucha and things like that by, I don't know if you know him, but Sander Katz, who has he even has a website, Wild Fermentation.
Well, Becky, thanks so much for calling and joining the conversation. We have so many people calling and posting here. Catherine on Facebook, I used to ferment my own sauerkraut at home. I enjoyed fermenting lots of vegetables, but my husband complained about the smell, so I stopped doing it. I might find a place in the basement to do it again because naturally fermented foods are delicious. So Catherine is spilling a little secret. It smells.
Yeah, generally. It smells kind of bad.
Yeah, I've tried making sauerkraut, and the smell was kind of overwhelming. I think in the old days they probably did it out in the barn where they, the smells were in the barn anyway, so it didn't matter so much. But I don't know whether that's true of other vegetables or just of cabbage.
A lot of vegetables do smell, but cabbage is a particularly stinky one.
I do think that there is a way to combat that, or you know, you could experiment with this. They sell jars with drilled lids, and you can use an airlock on the jar, which is like a device that allows air to escape but doesn't allow air to come in. And I've experimented with that and found that it cuts down a little bit on the smell. There's still going to be a smell, and for me, that's I actually don't mind it. It's kind of part of the process.
An email from Sam. Are the bacteria used in fermentation all different in the different products, like in miso or pickles or kimchi? How do you get the right kind to grow?
So actually, all of those products have different microbes. So miso is actually created by mold. And a lot of people actually think, you know, we hear mold, it's a bad thing. Well, if you like cheese or any of these other products, you're eating mold. There's a good kind of mold. We kind of fight fire with fire in that aspect. We inoculate with a mold we know won't hurt us and also has benefits to us. So, for instance, koji is the mold used in miso that breaks down the starches of the soybeans and kind of starts the whole fermentation. Pickles would be acetobacter. So those guys create acetic acid, which is vinegar. And then the more common one we find in a lot of fermentation are lactobacillus and other lactic acid bacteria. You know, they'll find them prevalent in, you know, kimchi, sauerkraut, hot sauces, things like that.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more and if your comments and questions about fermentation. You are listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do The Milk House, a Maine dairy farm producing organic whole milk yogurt. A complete list of where to find Milk House yogurt is available at mainmilkhouse.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Have you told a lie today? Psychologist Dan Ariely says dishonesty can be a sign of a creative mind.
Why do creative people cheat more? Because cheating is all about being able to tell a story about why what we want is actually okay.
Escaping the Truth, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
You can listen to Hidden Brain Sunday morning at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up today at 2, ideas from the CBC. For Valentine's Day, the amorous heart, why we love the heart symbol. You might think that the heart symbol and romantic love have always been bedfellows, but you'd be wrong. Ideas traces the centuries-long journey of how the symbol took on all the meanings it has today.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today, on this Valentine's Day, we are learning about fermentation. Here with me, Justin Amaral with Maniacal Yeast Labs, Kate Wallace with Resilience Hub, and Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who's a food expert, journalist, and historian. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. This says something to the sense of humor that you, Nancy, and our producer, Cindy, share, booking a show on fermentation on Valentine's Day. I hear you don't like sweets.
No, I don't, not very much. And I certainly don't like chocolates very much.
Oh, my goodness. I like you anyway, but I don't understand. we'll go to Kim, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much. This is actually really timely because I've been wanting to find out the answer to this question. Just trying now to different varieties of kombucha, and I'm wondering about alcohol content, when it's safe to drink it, when you want to drive, take it during the day, and just alcohol content in general on kombucha.
Sure. Justin?
Yeah. So that is actually a huge problem. In the industry, some kombucha you can pick up off the shelf is upwards of 3 to 5%, and it's not labeled as such. That's because they bottled it too quickly. So the general rule of thumb is when your pH is down below 3, and that, you know, it's been over a month. The bacteria in there actually eat the alcohol that's created because it is created during its fermentation, and that's what creates your acid bite. So I would say about a month, but you know, you'll be able to kind of taste it and see if it has that alcohol burn, but they generally float in underneath 0.5% if they're actually fermented fully out.
And so in a kombucha that you're going to buy at a store that you're not making is probably going to have a very low alcohol content.
It should, and that's the big problem we're hitting. A lot of people aren't really getting the analysis done on them, and they're bottling things that are alcoholic So that's one issue that actually, for instance, University of UMaine is looking into very heavily. But if you do it yourself, yeah, just let it ferment out completely and it should get rid of all the alcohol.
All right. Well, Kim, thanks for that question. Good question. Kate on Facebook says, I teach food preservation through the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. We offer hands-on workshops to teach people how to ferment. I have one coming up in April with Scarborough Adult Ed, but we offer them all over the state. I cannot tell you how many Maine Calling programs we have where the answer to at least one of the questions is call the Cooperative Extension. What an incredible resource in this state. We're going to go to Jesse calling from Sweden, Maine. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on and great show on fermentation. I love fermentation. it gets really exciting for me when you start using the naturally occurring microorganisms in the air, like, you know, making a kraut or something like that. Making cider, where you just rely on whatever's in the juice to get it going. And I find that I end up with much more interesting flavors than when I use a commercial yeast. Maybe the gentleman on your panel would like to talk about the difference between using the indigenous microorganisms and the ones that are produced in a laboratory setting.
Yeah, sure. So the ones, the commercial yeast strains are generally like the Saccharomyces strains that you can buy from almost any lab. Those are the ones that make more of the clean ciders. But a wild cider, however, goes through multiple stages of fermentation. And just for instance, out of commercial wild ciders we've isolated out of, we can find over hundreds of different microbes in them. So the complexity comes through the diversity of microbes that are in there. It's basically like, you know, one may create a chemical and that other one in there will eat that chemical and turn it into something else. So it's almost a never-ending chain. That's why a lot of ciders may be fermented for long periods of time, because you need those chemicals to be created for them to be created in the long term. And that ends up adding all different types of very, like, interesting chemicals that could create pineapple flavors, you know, really unique flavors that you wouldn't find in a clean cider. And that's because you're using a vast diversity of microbes in the ferment.
Jesse, thanks for the question. Becky on Facebook says, what kind of fermented products can be good for someone who cannot digest cabbage or broccoli family vegetables well and is also lactose intolerant?
Wine.
Seconded.
Is wine the answer to everything, Nancy?
Wine is the answer to everything. It's the answer to Valentine's Day, clearly. Anybody else?
Vinegar. I mean, I guess you could use vinegar. If it doesn't upset your stomach, a lot of people do take vinegar shots for probiotic shots.
It's also my understanding, and Justin, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, that lactic acid bacteria and lactobacillus are fine for people who are lactose intolerant.
Lactose is the chemical of like milk sugar. So lactobacillus is it's actually got that name because it can ferment lactose. So, but it has nothing to do with lactose being present.
So, you can basically lacto ferment any vegetable.
Yes.
So if you can't take vegetables in the brassica family, try fermenting carrots.
I also think it's interesting that in cultures that are not fresh milk drinking cultures for adults, like throughout the Mediterranean, many people are lactose intolerant in the sense that they can't tolerate fresh milk, but they'll eat yogurt and they'll eat cheese. And I wonder, I think people who are diagnosed as lactose intolerant might try a small amount of yogurt or small amount of cheese or small amount of kefir or kefir, however you pronounce it, just a small amount to see if that works. And if it does, then you have an ideal solution.
You know, it's funny you mentioned kefir, or I guess kefir. That's how it's called. Yeah, because we have an email from Christina. She says she wants to mention that kefir is a fermented milk drink, even more powerful probiotic than yogurt, and it tastes delicious. The fermentation takes part due to a combination of yeast and good bacteria, and you can find it in health food stores across the state of Maine. So that email came in as you were talking about it.
It's also quite easy to make if you can get your hands on a culture. You basically take a jar of milk and put these little gelatinous, they call them grains, into the milk and leave it overnight or for 24 hours, depending on how sour you want your milk to be.
We'll go to Tom, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello there. Back in the 1960s, I spent some time in Sweden. And then I was introduced to this delicious dish called surströmming. Essentially, surströmming is, well, in back in the day, they used to salt herring and put it in barrels and then bury it in the ground. And at the end of the barrel, there was surströmming. You could also buy it in the supermarkets there, and you could tell how good it was by how much it had expanded the ends of the can. if we were holding surströmming parties in the apartment, we would warn everybody. Actually, we would invite them and tell them what we were doing. Let me say, it has a very powerful odor, but an extremely delicious taste. So once you get past the smell, it tastes good.
Well, Sam, Tom, I'm glad you shared that story. As a teenager, I was lucky enough to go to Sweden, and my Swedish relatives opened lutefisk but they did it. They held the can under water in a stream to open it. They must be related, Nancy.
I'm sure they are. Although lutefisk is really, it's dried cod that has been, I think, put in a lye bath, which is another subject entirely. And we could go into lye treatment of foods on another program, maybe.
So that's not fermented, but the surströmming is.
I think it is. And I think it's related to garum, which is what the ancient Romans really loved. It's a fermented fish sauce. And today there is the fish sauces from Southeast Asia that we all love. Those are all fermented. And I'm sure the surströmming, if I pronounce it right, is part of that same.
So, Tom, I have to quiz you and ask you for an honest answer. A fish that's been fermented in a can that's had its ends pop out tastes good? Really?
If you get past the smell, it tastes good.
That's a big if, it sounds like. Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. We're going to go to Wendy calling from Belfast. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead.
Hi. I was going to talk about one of my favorite ferments that I've just recently made. It's something called beet kvass, and that's K-V-A-S-S. It's like an Eastern European beet drink, and it's also lacto-fermented, and it's really simple to make. It's as basic as just cutting up cubes of beets and adding some water and salt to like a 2 or 3% brine, and then I let mine sit for about a week, but you could do it longer if you wanted it's a little more robust taste, and then you strain off the beets, and you have this really delicious liquid that you can just drink, just like a little shot of it, or you can use it in salad dressings and other sauces. And then I've also found that I could use the beets that have been in the brine in other dishes that are really quite delicious too. So it's another tasty way to get probiotics into your diet, and it's kind of Eastern European origin, if I didn't say that already. And I just thought I would share that because it tastes so much better than what it might sound like.
Thanks so much for your call, Wendy. And Justin, you know kvass.
Yeah, so kvass actually originally comes from Russia. It was everything in the kitchen sink ferment, like what you had available. And then it started kind of sweeping through Europe in different forms. So beet kvass is one of those ones that got formed. There's lots of different kvass, but beet is the one that's currently becoming the most popular because it has a good flavor, which is kind of the key point for most people.
Yeah, flavor's good. Thanks, yeah. Wendy, for your call. We're going to go to Carrie, who's calling from New Market, New Hampshire. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm from Michigan and live near a bunch of apple orchards. And my parents would always get the fresh-pressed cider, and then they'd bring it home and open the top and just sit it in the corner, and it'd warm up for 4 or 5 days. And it would just lose that super sweetness and get slightly carbonated. And I don't know, I'm a chemist, so it might have been a fraction of a percent alcohol. So when I moved out here, I find that it's very hard to find unpreserved cider. You can't get it in a store. I think you have to only get it where it's made. So anyway, I teach high school, and I would take this, I would do the same thing. If I had a good batch, I'd keep a starter from the end of that gallon, and then I'd open the next gallon and I'd put that starter in and give it a head start. And then I'd take it to school, and I found that the students had no concept. They would think of the hard cider as being what you buy in the store as an alcoholic drink. They didn't understand how the subtle flavor addition you get by reducing the sugar and getting that little carbonation. And I'd pass it around, and they'd all have their noses up, and then they taste it and enjoy it immensely. So I just thought I'd pass on that little anecdote.
Oh, thanks, Carrie.
We used to do that at Gould Academy when I was a student there. We kept the cider in the closet so the faculty and the house mother wouldn't find it. And we hoped that it would ferment into something alcoholic. But I think it was more in our imaginations than anything else.
Carrie, thanks so much. An email from Michelle. You're going to like this one, Kate. I can't imagine a better Valentine's Day present for my fermentophile spouse than to send him to the fermentation fair, but I'm not on Facebook and I can't seem to find out where, when, or how one gets to this fair. More information, please.
Sure. So the fermentation fair is Wednesday, February 20th. It's from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. and it's at the Resilience Hub, which is at 224 Anderson Street in Portland. And there's parking on site. It's shaping up to be a pretty popular event, so you might want to get there early. We're going to have tastings and a contest, so bring your fermented items to share. And we'll also have demonstrations. Justin will be on hand to talk about yeast and bacteria and cultures. And it's going to be a great community event. We're really excited about it.
All right. Well, we're going to try to squeeze in one more question. We're going to go to David from Dover Foxcroft. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I recently started making kimchi, and I love it. And sometimes it really seems to bubble and ferment nicely, and other times not much seems to happen at all. And I'm not sure what the problem is.
Looking for tips.
So the bubbling is generally that you have a stronger yeast culture. Yeast are the ones that create the CO2, so the bubbles you see come up. In some cases, you may see some lag between fermentations. It could just be the yeast is kind of slowly, sluggishly growing up. But as long as it's getting sour, it's protecting itself. So that's kind of the key point. So they won't always bubble between batches.
Okay, so even when he thinks his kimchi isn't working, it probably is.
Yes, if it's starting to get sour, that's kind of the key point that, you know, it's safe. But it may not always be as vigorous as fermentation from batch to batch.
Okay. Did you have a tip, Nancy?
No, I don't know anything about this. I just go by my nose more than anything else.
I would say that just, you know, one thing that we haven't touched on is the role that temperature plays in fermentation. And, you know, these microorganisms are, they're like us. They have temperature tolerances. And so when it's cold, they'll slow down like we do. And when it's warm, they'll get a little crazy and do weird things and make strange off flavors potentially. And so, you know, that could be playing a role as well.
All right. Well, David, thanks for your call. Thank you for everybody who called or emailed or tweeted today. Wasn't able to get to everybody, but there's a nice conversation going on our Facebook page that you're welcome to join after the program. Thank you to our guests here in the studio, Kate Wallace, Programming Director at the Resilience Hub, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, food historian and journalist, author and speaker, and Justin Amaral, co-owner and head of lab services at Maniacal Yeast Labs. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.